For many people, as you rightly intimate, the idea that right at the heart of power in a liberal democracy, you have an inherited role is a complete anathema. I would say it wasn't a problem particularly. Just because something's a liberal democracy, it doesn't mean that all positions of power and authority need to be subject to...
meritocracy?
Well, need to be subject to immediate democratic accountability.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Matilda Fasting, and today I'm joined by Nick Spencer. He's a senior fellow at the Theos think tank in the UK. And we're going to talk about a lot of different things, but we will start with talking about the future of liberal democracies, because Nick has come to Norway to discuss this. And I'll just have to say, first of all, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we'll start with this purpose of your trip to Norway. And you're always visiting to discuss the future of liberal democracies. So what are your main thoughts? And do you think that liberal democracies, do they have a future?
I hope so, but that's not quite the question you asked. I think they do. But I think that anybody who has any eye on the news at the moment realises that the immediate prospects are challenging. There is a obviously external challenge from rising autocracies, most obviously Russia, but I suppose China as well, which has provided a model for authoritarian capitalism that people didn't think was sustainable 30 years ago. Probably even more significantly, there are internal challenges with regards to a large disaffection amongst the populations, the voting populations, or more accurately, the non-voting populations of liberal democracies, and even data from opinion polls showing that an increasing number of people, particularly young people worryingly, would prefer a strong man, and it often is a man, to drive home their policies without the encumbrance and the debate and the uncertainty of liberal democracy. So there are external and internal challenges.
But then for the future of this, we are talking before the elections, for instance, in Italy, a huge European country where things are looking to be not just a strong man, but a strong woman, maybe.
Yes.
Even though she is in a coalition with other quite far-right populist parties. So these things, and also the ongoing conflicts that we have, do you think that that will make it harder for liberal democracies to succeed or to sustain themselves?
Yes, in a short answer, it will. I do think that liberal democracies are obviously morally preferable to many of the alternative autocracies. I also think they're probably more effective, but the worrying thing at the moment is, for a combination of factors, large numbers of people in liberal democracies do not feel that they are sufficiently enfranchised, do not feel that their views and needs are taken account of by the mainstream parties. And that's one of the reasons why they're increasingly turning to populist parties or fringe parties or far-right or far-left parties that can offer them solutions, or at least claim to offer them solutions.
Yeah. Let's just also have a look at your own country, the UK, because right before the Queen died a little while ago, we're going to talk about that later, but this was Liz Truss coming into office. And what do you think will happen in the UK as she is not representing a populist party. She is a woman, and she claims also to have some solutions for the deep problems that UK faces right now, energy, all the things that's happening in the world.
Liz Truss is obviously a relatively unknown phenomenon politically. And the other thing you have to remember is she is now the fourth Conservative leader of a Conservative, or at least Conservative-led governments. So Conservatives have been in power since 2010, and she is their fourth leader. And she follows Boris Johnson, who, irrespective of what you think of him, managed to connect with people in quite extraordinary ways. She does not have anything like his charisma. In fact, I have to say she's one of the least charismatic politicians I think I've seen in my lifetime. And she also has approached a very worrying cost of living crisis with the prime objective of growing the economy through significant tax cuts and unprecedentedly high levels of borrowing. She has 2 years before she faces the before she faces the population again. And conservatives tend to get into power because they are trusted with the economy. So she's paying an enormous gamble. People will already be quite tired of conservative government. They've had it for 15 years by the time the next election comes about. If her gamble to grow the economy and negotiate the cost of living crisis by that means doesn't pay off, I suspect her tenure will be a short one.
Mm. And then the Labour Party will come.
We don't formally have a two-party system, but for all intents and purposes, we have a two-party system.
Yes, I know. At the time of this recording, as we just mentioned, Queen Elizabeth II's funeral has just taken place, and she was queen for about 70 years, and her reign was constitutional. But could you see the UK as a republic in the future?
No.
No?
Well, not in the immediate future. The public opinion polling on that question is remarkably consistent in the UK. Usually between 70 to 80% of people want to retain a monarchy. There are a hardcore of 20% of Republicans, and that goes up a little bit at certain times. One of the questions that everyone has been asking in the wake of the Queen's death is the public's attachment to the monarchy, or rather was the public's attachment to the monarchy actually a the public's attachment to the Queen,
yeah,
as opposed to the monarchy. King Charles, as he is now, has never been anything like as popular as she was. But then again, nobody has been. The early signs are that transfer of affection has been relatively seamless, and there are no serious moves towards republicanism. But public opinion is naturally quite fickle. And I wouldn't say it was impossible in the future. The one thing I would say is that the British in general, the English in particular, love their history. They love their tradition. You would have seen the extraordinary outpouring of public affection in the last few weeks or so. That was, of course, because of the Queen, but it was also because of the history and the traditions that she symbolised and embodied. And I think we would be very reluctant to do anything that challenged that.
Yeah. And then, as you say, it is the monarchy is an institution that plays another role than a president would have done. And even though this is paradoxical in many ways, just like we have here in Norway, a monarch, but also a liberal democracy on the other side, which would normally say it should be republican, that is the normal way to think about it. But you think that history will play a role and will continue to play a role. And how is that important, do you think?
Nations require a sense of us, a sense of what it is that we hold in common. That is increasingly under stress in our current climate. The monarchy, certainly in the UK, and most obviously in the reign of the Queen, provided a very centripetal force. It drew us together, and it embodied a sense of this is what we belong to. I think that's incredibly valuable. Societies can overplay that at the extent of individual liberties and freedoms, and you know, historically, theocracies or totalitarian dictatorships have had highly concentrated centripetal forces that have crushed individual liberty. But tradition is a way of reminding us of what we belong to, that there is a sense of cohesion, a sense of a common value and a common good without crushing those individual liberties. So it plays a very important role. And I think almost subconsciously, the British are aware of that.
Mm. So the Queen was, as I understand it, a devout Christian. And do you think this has been significant for her reign and the monarchy? And how does religion come into place here?
Religion, or more specifically Christianity, has a very paradoxical role in Britain at the moment. So you're right, she was a very devout Christian. The monarch is the supreme governor of the Church of England, so it has a significant role there. She was an active defender of the Church of England, but she was also an active defender of the Church of England, defending faith in general in England. And her funeral, because it was a personal funeral, was of course deeply Christian, and her coronation is a deeply Christian affair. If you've ever read the coronation oath, the coronation service, it's extraordinary. I mean, it is a Christian service. So on the one hand, that Christianity is absolutely at the centre, right in the reactor core of Britishness, and in particular Englishness. At the same time, our census, our decadal census will be published, the religion question will be published probably next month, and that'll be in October. And it will show that, my prediction is that it will show that for the first time ever, fewer than 50% of people in the UK call themselves Christian.
Oh.
And probably, I'm guessing, 35 to 40% of people will call themselves no religion. So you have this paradox of Christianity as a social identifier, at least, being at a very low point, just at the moment when we're about to have a coronation where it is absolutely central. There are lots of people who will be arguing about this. I can tell you now that the coronation will remain thoroughly Christian, but it does generate a tension that will be difficult to negotiate in the 21st century.
Mm. Yeah, but the coronation then will be next summer or something, is it? So
they haven't said yet, but it's usually about 12 months.
Okay, so yes. So you suspect that the debates about these paradoxes will come to the surface and be debated in the UK?
There will be a lively public debate. We published a report at Theos about 7 years ago called Who Wants a Christian Coronation, in which we did public opinion polling. And broadly speaking, the answer is the British public. Because Christianity is still, as it were, we live in the afterglow of Christendom, it is woven into the tradition and the historical fabric of the nation, and people, by and large, are very happy with it. And more to the point, what's the alternative? There is no neutral alternative. So it will be there. The other important thing to emphasise is the coronation in Britain, or England as it was, dates back 1,000 years or so. It has changed consistently over that time in subtle and sometimes significant ways to reflect the changed nature of the country and the changed religious concerns of the country. So there's nothing to say it can't be tweaked and modified to reflect the fact that will be 2023 as opposed to 1953. But the coronation as a Christian service will remain. There will be this penumbra of active debate around it. Mm.
Do you think it is also due to what another podcast guest that I had about a year ago, Tom Holland, who's British, of course, and he said that everything is Christian. Christian is dominion. And with that, he meant that it has all things that we think about as Christian have come into our lives in such a way that we are not thinking of them, those things, as Christian anymore, but they are part of us. And that's why we accept these Christian things without really thinking that they are strange.
So I know Tom, and actually he's delivering our annual lecture this year, and I know
okay.
and like the book greatly. I largely agree with that. I mean, his argument is that it's the air we breathe, and like the air you breathe, you don't notice it. And for the large part, I think that's right. I do think there has been a significant shift, not a subtle shift, in the last 50 years or so, whereby, let me put it this way, historically, the idea of Christian uniqueness, equality, freedom, dignity, is rooted in some clear Christian, the idea that humans are equal, free, dignified, so on and so forth, is rooted in certain Christian creeds. We wouldn't quite say that today. We have shifted since the liberal revolution of the 1960s towards a belief that human dignity and equality rests in our exercise of agency, our free choice. Now, that's part of Christian idea, but it's not the whole Christian idea. So I think that the territory is changing subtly, and those Christian ideas aren't quite as dominant as they would have been a couple of generations ago. But the poet T.S. Eliot once wrote that a society has not stopped being Christian until it has decisively become something else. And ours has not decisively become something else. It has drifted away from certain Christian ideas, But they still remain, if you like, the most visible ones on the landscape. Mm.
So you think it will last another 1,000 years?
Well, I can say that because I won't be around to defend my claim in 1,000 years' time.
Neither would I. But the UK, as we have just said, is a secular liberal democracy with a monarch who inherits his position or her position. But at the same time, people see it as a guarantee for liberal democracy. How?
For many people, as you rightly intimate, the idea that right at the heart of power in a liberal democracy, you have an inherited role is a complete anathema. I would say it wasn't a problem particularly. Just because something's a liberal democracy, it doesn't mean that all positions of power and authority need to be subject to...
meritocracy?
Well, need to be subject to immediate democratic accountability, I suppose. We have a bicameral system in the UK, the House of Commons and the House of Lords. The House of Lords is a mess, frankly, but it's not an elected mess. But interestingly, if you look at public opinion with regard to the extent to which people trust different public authorities, if I were to ask you where you think the House of Commons, the House of Lords and the monarchy reside in public opinion, a Democrat would say, well, obviously the House of Commons is most trusted because we can get rid of our MPs. You can't get rid of your peers and you obviously can't get rid of your monarch. But of course, it's actually the opposite. And in terms of public trust and affection, the monarchy is trusted more than the Lords, and the Lords is trusted more than the Commons. There are more than one way of representing than voting. And in many ways, the second chamber, the House of Lords, represents different constituencies within the country without them actually voting for them. And of course, the point of the monarch was that, I mean, the Queen once said, I have to be seen to be believed, by which she meant that she needed to be around, she needed to do her duty, she needed to be in contact with people in very different forms of life to be giving that monarchical imprimatur and recognition to what they're doing. So liberal democracies don't necessarily have to reside simply on patterns of voting. There are different ways of representing public interests. And the mixed system we have in the UK allows for, you know, the executive to be drawn from elected representatives, but other systems to introduce different forms of representation. And that allows simultaneously an immediate responsiveness to public opinion through House of Commons, but also a degree of continuity, which is necessary through the Lords and the monarchy. Mm-hmm. And basically the system, broadly speaking, works.
Yeah, because the monarch, I believe I've read in some articles now after the Queen's death that also stability, safety and trust and those things in a person that really is there of all the time, and she's not, or he is not going to be changed at any point unless he or she, well, when she dies, but then she will be replaced by someone who will continue this tradition, and that means a lot to people. So that's obviously what you are trying to say.
It means a lot to people personally, kind of affectionately. I went up to Buckingham Palace a few days after the Queen died, mainly because I was interested in observing the phenomenon. And the flowers that were there were extraordinary. And I read the cards that were open. And there was this, they were like really reading love letters. It was quite extraordinary. So there was that deep, deep personal affection there. But constitutionally, as you say, it does offer a stability and a continuity, which is very important amidst the rough and tumble of politics.
Let's just go to another kind of question that also involves Christianity, because usually Christianity has been the basis for many political parties. And you have an interesting observation about the UK, where you don't have, Christian democratic party in such a way that it will have that in their name or something like that. What do you have?
I once wrote a book on the history of the influence of the Bible and Christianity on British politics. And I observed in that in a strange way, Britain never developed a tradition of Christian democracy as you did here, as many countries on the continent did, because we already had three. So British Christianity has been fragmented for quite a long time. And as the political parties, or the modern political parties at least, were formed in the 19th century, the Conservative Party had a strong, implicit, sometimes explicit alliance with the Anglican Church. The Labour Party had a strong link with the non-conformist churches and also, well, some of the non-conformist churches and also the Catholic Church. And the Liberal Party had very strong links with some non-conformist churches. So each of the main three political parties, so this is about 100 or so years ago, had strong links with particular Christian denominations. And so therefore there wasn't a need for a Christian democratic movement, because if you like, we already had a quasi-Christian democratic movement within the Conservative Party and the Labour Party and the Liberal Party.
So that's how you came about not having a Christian democratic party at all. Because all of them were.
they had strong links. I mean, none of them badged themselves in that way. And all parties are always coalitions. And each of those parties had obviously non-Christian elements within them. But nonetheless, each of them identified with a particular feature on the Christian landscape.
So you just mentioned that there's going to be a poll next month in October. And this is related to my question here, how politics and religion will be intertwined in the future. Are we, and then I would say in the West, becoming more religious, and then not only more Christian, but religious in a broader sense, or are we becoming more secular, or is it going to stay like a 50-50 mix?
So I think we're becoming more plural is the short answer to that. So we're not becoming more religious, with some exceptions. There's a very interesting example. We did a report a few years ago on called Religious London. Wherever you go in the world, broadly speaking, cities are less religious than rural areas. Religion is an extraordinary exception to that. It is now the most religious place in the UK, and it has become more religious. Now, it's almost entirely because of immigration, and not just Christian immigration, but Muslim immigration too. So there are exceptions, but generally speaking, let's limit our discussion to Western Europe. Countries are becoming less Christian. They're also becoming less religious generally. They are becoming more secular, but they're not becoming fully secular. And so the landscape in, say, 10, 20, 30 years' time is one which there is a significant secular plurality, probably, but also large minorities of significant religious groups. And the important point to emphasize there is that just because somebody ticks the no religion box on the census, it doesn't mean they are an atheist. We're publishing a report on this next month, analysing effectively what the census data mean. And a large proportion of people who are non-religious are also very self-consciously spiritual. They just don't like the religious badge. And another large group of people who are non-religious are atheistic, but are actually quite pro the role of religion within culture and society. So even within that secular category, it's quite mixed. And what we're going to be facing in the 21st century in the UK, and I suspect in most Western countries, is a situation where no one group is hegemonic, and lots of different ideologies and beliefs and commitments are rubbing shoulders with one another in a rather messy public square.
Hmm. Yeah, and when you say messy public square, do you think that those trends will lead to more polarization, more trouble?
I find one's answer to that question is almost always a reflection of one's personality. If you're an optimist, you say, no, I think we can muddle through this. If you're a pessimist, you put your head in your hands and you say, oh, yes. I've got to be honest with you, I'm not by nature an optimist. My closest friends wouldn't accuse me of optimism. We have noticed the way in which deep issues of identity have influenced political discussion the last 20 years or so. So whereby three generations ago, you and I might have disagreed vigorously about proper economic policy. Now, those public disagreements are equally likely to be around conceptions of identity, which are now played out in the public square. That doesn't bode well for a public square that is plural. Because if you start investing all your identity and commitment in your group identity, your religious or your secular or, you know, your ethnic or whatever identity, then negotiating that with other people who are different becomes more challenging. And just to add this into the mix as well, we will see hundreds of millions of environmental migrants in this next century. That is enormously destabilizing. It's obviously more destabilizing for the migrants themselves who have lost their ability to live in the countries they want to, but it will be obviously be enormously destabilizing to countries that receive them. We only had to look at that with the Syrian migrant crisis back in 2015 or whenever it was. That put strain on people. That is, broadly speaking, correlated to the rise of far-right parties that we were talking about earlier. So that is not a happy recipe. I don't want to be a doom monger, but we do need to go into the future with eyes open to the reality of the seriousness of the situation.
Yeah. I hope I'm probably a bit more optimistic, but I get your point. Populist right-wing political parties seem to use Christian values in their rhetoric, but you claim that they are often non-religious, and that is a paradox in a way. So can you explain then how they are using Christian values in their propaganda or in their arguments, and they by themselves are not Christian necessarily in the leadership of those parties?
So the target of a great deal of populist parties is migration, it's multiculturalism, it's Islam in particular. And one of the ways they have formulated their arguments or their rhetoric in these matters is that we need to defend Christian Europe or defend Christendom. It is the case, I think I'm right in saying, that the leaders of many populist parties in Europe are not known for their Christian faith in the first instance. Secondly, it is interesting that Christian leaders across Europe have been often in the front rank of criticising populist parties. There's a reason why Pope Francis is a particular bête noire for populist leaders, because he has made defending the migrant and the asylum seeker a major feature of his papacy, and they don't like that. And the third interesting point is that there's been some polling around the fact that people who vote for or support populist parties often have a Christian identity, but it's a nominal identity, whereas active church-going Christians are less likely to support these populist parties. Now, I would caveat that with saying that we need much more research in this area, but that does tend to show that those who have a kind of a nominal allegiance to a vague Christian identity are persuaded by these populist arguments about defending Christian Europe. But those who have an active living faith are much more sceptical, because they know the danger of associating a belief like Christianity with a kind of a political creed, such as we see in populist parties.
Mm, yeah, so that's we're turning now to a place where religion and politics seem to be very much mixed, and that is, of course, Russia and what's happening there. Because what are your thoughts about the Orthodox Church connections to Putin, for instance, and what's happening with religion and politics in Russia at the moment?
I'm depressed by it, is the short answer. We've just been talking about nominal Christian identity, and nominal Russian Orthodox identity is incredibly important in Russia. So there was this extraordinary outpouring of devotion to the Russian Orthodox Church in the 1990s. And not surprisingly, after 17 years of pretty brutal suppression, the fact that people could worship openly without fear was hugely celebrated. So I don't know exactly what the figures are, but I know that a very large proportion of Russians will identify as Russian Orthodox. But the point there is that Russian Orthodox is seen as a bulwark for Russianness. It is being part of being Russian. And that, combined with obviously the highly controlled media message that Putin directs to the people, means that if you're a Russian Orthodox believer, of course you support your president, because he supports your church, and he is, quote-unquote, defending your country. The depressing thing here is that the church hierarchy has seemingly been entirely open and prepared to be manipulated in this way, effectively. And that whereas you would have hoped that somebody committed to the gospel of Jesus Christ would challenge bellicose rhetoric, let alone warmongering, the church hierarchy has thoroughly supported it. And whereas one can excuse rank and file Russian Orthodox Christians because this is effectively what they've been told, the way in which the hierarchy has been prepared to rubber stamp, you know, a pretty brutal and entirely unjustified invasion is, you know, worrying to the point of disgraceful, really.
Mm. How important do you think that the Christianity and the church will be for the Ukrainians?
Now, that's a very good question. I should say that I'm not very good, not really qualified to answer it, except in as far as to say that I suspect it will and is playing a rallying role around identity and Ukrainians' desire for freedom. So I don't know, frankly, what the level of church going is in Ukraine. But I suspect that, I mean, partly because I think I'm right in saying there are different rites, R-I-T-E-S, in Ukraine, there isn't such quite a homogenizing effect that religion plays in Ukraine. But nonetheless, I suspect it is and will function as a rallying point and as a kind of a mark of our identity and freedom. But like I said, I caveat that with the fact my knowledge of religion in Ukraine is quite weak.
But it seems reasonable what you're saying. So and then finally, we have been now talking a lot about religion and about how that plays out, especially Christianity in today's societies. Do you think that we need Christians around to keep this going in the future? And also at the same time, you could mention the books if the listeners would like to read more about these things. You might have some suggestions for them to read, because you have yourself written a couple of books. So go ahead.
There is a danger when answering this question that if you answer yes, people hear you saying Christians are better than other people, or we need Christians to keep us civilized. And I wouldn't say anything as blunt as that. What I would say is that Western civilization as we know it is thoroughly interwoven with Christianity. And to conceive of Europe even today without Christianity is impossible. Christianity has been foundational to the idea of Europe. It has been foundational to our conception of the person, of civil society, of the rule of law, even in strange ways, things like democracy and even weirdly secularism. It has also been absolutely central, not only to the symbolism of nations, as we've been talking about, but also to the basic pastoral care and concern for millions of people day in, day out across the continent. And by definition, you could not lose that and remain the same people. The same content. So the book I suspect you're referring to there is a book called The Evolution of the West that I wrote a few years ago, How Christianity Shaped Our Values, which looked at things like, as I mentioned, democracy, rule of law, human dignity, secularism, welfare state, and showed the extent to which each of those things owes something to Christian ideas and practices. I personally am of the opinion that Christianity is absolutely central to who we are and our future. And Europe would not be Europe without it. But I'm also conscious of the fact that levels of active church attendance have been declining. And that means that there are fewer Christians to engage in politics and fewer Christians to spread ideas and fewer Christians to engage in local pastoral work. And I think that would have ultimately a very harmful effect. But I don't want to end on a kind of a doom-mongering note. I'd like to emphasise the positive contribution that Christianity has made to the fabric of our societies and the way in which, you know, the church, in spite of, you know, some of the you know, obituaries that are written for it is alive and active and, broadly speaking, a very positive force across the continent.
Yeah, good. So that you ended on a positive note there. Thanks so much for joining me today, Nick. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
It's been a pleasure too.
And if you like Liberal Haltimer, rate us and recommend us or give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or my colleague eirik@civita.no. And information about Civita is available on our homepage, www.civita.no. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal Haltimer. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.